Hey everyone, we're back for another episode of the Hound Sign Center's podcast series, Off the Stage. My name is Maddie Miller. I'm the media specialist for the Hound Sign Center. And today I have three different interviews today, but up first we have Aaron Reichlin Melnick, who is the policy director at the American Immigration Council. Aaron, thanks for being here. Tell us where you traveled from.
Coming this way from Washington, D.C., nice. Where I have lived for 10 out of the last 12 years.
Okay, awesome. That's cool. And is the weather same or different than here in Michigan?
Well, normally it's a lot warmer. Right now it is. Well, I suppose it's also a lot warmer now. We're going through a bit of a heat spell. It's going to hit almost 70 by Friday.
Cool. Yeah, so a little bit warmer here in Michigan today, which I'm excited for compared to the weird winter we've had in the past couple of weeks. But Aaron is here for our bipartisan policy panel on immigration that we are hosting tonight. So once you are listening to this podcast, the event has already happened, but you can go to the link in the description where you'll find a recording of the event on YouTube or a recording of the event in podcast form. So I'm anticipating that's going to be a great conversation. So definitely check that out. We are going to start with our famous BOQ, bowl of questions. So Aaron, reach in there, grab a question, read it, and then you can answer it for us.
All right. Well, the first question I have is, are you good at typing? Do you use the home keys? The answer is yes. I am actually very good at typing.
Love that.
I found that that's actually a very valuable job skill.
Yes.
Because if you can translate your thoughts onto the keyboards and the virtual page more rapidly, you can get more stuff done.
Yeah.
Like typing skills are one of those like underrated job skills and nobody ever mentions it. But if you are actually good at typing and you have a job that requires you to write things, that is literally a time saving.
Yes, I could not agree more. Actually, I came up with this question because my dad did a 30-year career as a dentist, and then he has now transitioned to working as a retirement life coach. And one of the things he really struggles with is typing. And it was so bad to the point where it's like slowing him down, and they actually had him get a typing class because that is such a valuable skill. So I'm glad to hear you're a good typer.
Yeah, I grew up the old school AIM, MSN Messenger, you have it, instant messaging days of the 1990s, early 2000s, and got very good at rapid responses that way.
Love that. And do you use the home keys? Like, are you putting your hands on, like, the home keys?
I'm a touch typer. I don't look at the keyboard. I can type pretty much entirely without it. I occasionally
love it.
Do, like, the type eraciser things, and I think I can hit above 100 words.
I made my coworker play type eraser with me one time. So, good game. Okay, let's hear the next question.
All right. The next question is, what is your favorite brand of water bottle? I mean, are we talking like flavored, unflavored, or like?
I think I wrote this question. I was thinking brand as in like the actual like hardware of the water bottle.
Like
you
a
got
thermos
your, or... you got your Hydro Flask, you got your Stanleys, you got your, you know, whatever's, Camelback.
So, the one we use is Zojirushi. A couple. My aunt bought me one for Christmas, and now I'm a fan of them. They're the same as all of them, the vacuum sealed walls so that they also keep ice cold for hours or hot beverages for hours. They're great. Nothing against the Stanley Cup, but I got a bunch of the Zojirushis already, and I don't feel like I need more than the ones I have now.
Yeah, hey, I love to hear it. And since you mentioned it, do you have a favorite like flavor of water, like the different water brands?
No, actually, I'm more of like a classic water plus.
Okay, love to hear it. Awesome. Well, thank you for answering those questions from our lovely BOQ. I'm interested to see what the other panelists get today, because I wrote all those questions and just threw them in there, so... okay, so how I always usually start our interviews is just tell us like where you grew up, what were you interested in grade school in, like what did you do, and what was your childhood like, kind of?
Yeah, so I grew up in Nyack, New York, which is a small suburb about 35 minutes outside of Manhattan. So the New York suburbs, basically.
Yeah.
So it was a Hudson River river town. They're fairly liberal towns, but Nyack is pretty unique in the county is that it's very diverse. My high school when I grew up was about 50% non-white, 50% white, and for years it was ranked in one of the top 100 diverse schools in the country, and also a good school. I got a great education there. Mm-hmm. So when I left there, I went to college. In college, I worked as an intern for my local member of Congress and got to see firsthand a lot of the issues with the immigration system. Because for those who have ever done any kind of congressional work, one of the things you do, especially when you're an intern at a local office, is constituent services. And immigration is overwhelmingly one of the biggest constituent services issues out there. It's people applying for citizenship, people trying to bring their family members over, and people facing deportation all reach out to their member of Congress for help. So, you know, even in college, I was already getting a sense of what's going on with our immigration system and becoming like deeply interested in doing things to fix it.
Yeah, that's cool. And I saw that you have two different degrees. So your undergrad and a degree after undergrad. How did you decide what exactly you wanted to study?
Oh, I mean, I didn't. I was not one of those people who went into college going, I know exactly what I want to do.
Does anybody do that? I don't know.
Some people do. I've certainly met them. Yeah, some people are really clear about how they want to like go with their college career. You know, it's pre-med or whatever, pre-law. No, I had a vague sense that I wanted to be a lawyer, but I didn't really know. I did mock trial for 4 years in college. So,
That's cool.
It's not being a lawyer, but it's fun play acting
for
as a
lawyer. For sure, for sure.
So I got a degree in politics and East Asian studies. So originally I thought I was going to do politics and Spanish, and then I ended up politics and East Asian studies because after my freshman year I went, you know what, I've been doing Spanish since middle school. Let's go completely left field and study Mandarin for 3 years. So I studied Mandarin for 3 years, went to China for a summer, which was very fascinating. Then came back, worked as a, and that came back and graduated in 2009 in the midst of the financial crisis and got a job as a research assistant for a professor on campus and stayed there for 2 years before going to law school.
That's awesome. And remind me where you got your undergrad degree from?
Brandeis University, which is a small liberal arts school outside Boston.
Oh, cool. Cool. That's really cool. And any quick highlights from your summer in China? That sounds so cool.
It's great. I mean, I think China has this kind of weird mythos around it. There's a lot of people who sort of view the Chinese people as a you know, as a monolith. They're all the same. It's just not true. It's just, I mean, I recommend going to China and interacting with people. People are great. You know, if you speak the language, they're super friendly. They want to use their English. They want to talk with you. I was actually not allowed to speak in English because it was a language program. So I would have great conversations where they'd be practicing their English with me and I'd be practicing my Mandarin with them.
That's cool.
Ate better than I've ever eaten. And, you know, and China is beautiful. We did get some trips out into the countryside and you've got beautiful islands along the coast. You've got mountain valleys and streams, forested areas. It's a bit like the United States that way. There's a whole lot of variety in the wildlife and environment of China. And I was not staying in a city that had a huge pollution problem, which is nice. I mean, certainly it was smoggy, but it was not like Beijing where it's really bad.
Yeah, that's cool. That sounds really cool. I would love to make it there someday. Speaking of, so you said you did a little bit of Spanish and then Mandarin. How is it today? Are you still fluent in any of those or?
I speak Spanish professionally.
Okay, cool.
And so I practiced as an immigration lawyer for 2 years with heavily Spanish speaking clients. So my Spanish got significantly better during that period to the point that I'm comfortable doing legal consultations and talking about people's cases. But I always joke, you know, if you want to tell me about the awful things that happened to your home country or what your convictions were or you know, things related to your legal case, I can have that conversation for hours. But if you want to have a conversation about what we both did last weekend or point at things on, you know, in the room and say, name all of these things, I'm going to struggle.
Okay, cool.
My Mandarin is not good anymore.
Okay.
I still understand a small amount of it. I can speak a small amount of it, but it's a user to lose it kind of language.
For sure. Yeah. I feel like that, like with any language, I did Spanish for a long time in school and I actually just got back from a trip to Guatemala and where I like was like remembering all these Spanish words that I used to use. And I was like, dang, I'm sad that I like lost this because it is such a cool skill to be able to be bilingual and, you know, not just, you know, in your personal life, but professionally as well. So that's awesome.
Yeah. And especially useful in immigration. Now, of course, not all immigrants are Spanish speakers, but the strong majority of immigrants and non-citizens in the United States speak Spanish as a first language.
That's awesome. That's really cool to hear. So you've touched on a couple points in your career. I'm just wondering kind of broadly, and this, and if you have to think about this a little bit, totally fine, but what is like one thing that you've accomplished in your career that's made you really proud?
Oh, great question. So I've had a career, I've done a bunch of different things. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to pick one from my actual practicing days as a lawyer. Cool. After I graduated law school, I worked for 2 years as a doing removal defense, defending people that the government was seeking to deport. Okay. Most of my clients were what I would, you know, people in their 40s and 50s who had drug problems in the 80s mm-hmm. or 90s and had been pretty clean since then, but got picked up for their older convictions. But mm-hmm. I would say, you know, winning a case, actually successfully stopping someone yeah. from being deported. And, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of it, they gave me a tie and I'm wearing that today.
That's awesome.
You know, it's a good reminder to me that mm-hmm. even when you're not, you know, today I did do much more broad systemic work, but that was one person and mm-hmm. I stopped him from being deported, you know, and he did it himself too. Obviously, I can't take full credit.
Yeah.
But that was a thing that made me very proud. And then subsequent to that, I think I have testified in front of Congress a couple of times. And that also is a really exciting, interesting mm-hmm. experience. And I feel pretty proud of that, especially when I'm the only minority witness up there and there's three witnesses that oppose mm-hmm. the positions I'm taking and then just me to be the punching bag, as it were. and so that's really... It's fun, and it's something I feel pretty proud of.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really cool to hear. I just thought of this question because I've actually always been curious about this. When you have a client, like, what do you ever have contact with your clients like after the case? Like, do you like develop that kind of personal relationship with them, or is it really, are there a lot of like strict laws around like this remains professional or whatnot?
Yeah, it varies from person to person. Okay. You know, there are ethical rules about accepting gifts from current clients.
Okay, interesting,
so
yeah.
The various states have different bar rules, but mm-hmm. generally speaking, it's not okay to accept anything above a certain amount mm-hmm. From your clients that's reasonable. You know, your client, especially because I was working for people who didn't have money, it was nonprofit removal defense. So
okay.
These were people who didn't have tons of resources. So mm-hmm. if one of them had like handed me a $100 bill, I would have had to turn it down.
Yeah.
But, you know, small things like a tie, for instance, that was, I was able to say, all right, I'll take that one. And so I didn't really practice long enough to develop some really great relationships, but I've got friends who've been doing this for years mm-hmm. and some of them do, they get Christmas cards every year from their yeah. clients. I actually did get Christmas cards from one of my clients for, cool. a couple of years before mm-hmm. I moved. And I guess I didn't give them my new address. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are people who do that. I think it really just depends on the circumstances. As long as it doesn't become inappropriate, it's certainly fine to have a friendly relationship with an ex-client. You just have mm-hmm. to be careful about the professional boundaries if you're ever going to represent them.
Yeah, that's true. Cool. Thank you. Okay, so my next question is, so this year, the Hauenstein Center's programming, like our academic year, is all focused around this idea of empowered citizenship. That is our theme for the year, and it's just thinking about how we can empower others to be citizens of our country, citizens of our world, our communities, and make it a better place. Obviously, tonight's topic on immigration fits perfectly in that, you know, citizenship in our country. But I was just wondering, how do you think the idea of empowered citizenship applies to the work you do in your career, but also could just for you as a citizen of our country and for you personally?
Yeah, so I mean, I'll start with the professional side of things mm-hmm. or sort of like the broader advocacy point. Members of Congress listen to people. If you mm-hmm. call into a office and they and say, I oppose X or support Y, mm-hmm. someone there is going to write that down mm-hmm. and they are going to go to their boss and they're going to say, hey, we got 15 calls today. 13 of them were in favor and 2 of them were opposed. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that, quite frankly, can actually make a difference. You know, yeah. if you flood people's lines with calls and, you know, listen to them, that sort of stuff works. Beyond that, though, in personal lives, I think modeling welcoming and belonging to people, especially to new immigrants. Obviously, not every immigrant needs the same thing. So what is welcoming and belonging to one person might not be to another, but treating people like people, you know, approaching them respectfully and letting them know that you're okay with them in their community, that they belong here, that they're yeah. part of the American fabric, I think mm-hmm. can be really, really helpful for making people feel like they're part of the country rather than approaching people standoffishly or sort mm-hmm. of suspiciously. And sometimes it's just about making a positive effort to model belonging and support. Mm-hmm. And even if it's not direct, let people see that you're doing it. And it's mm-hmm. a message that spreads. Mm-hmm. We believe, you know, my organization is something called the Center for Inclusion and Belonging. And we do a lot of mm-hmm. research into this. And we find that belonging, being part of a community, is one of the most powerful things for people. Mm-hmm. So if you help people become part of a community, you don't sort of mm-hmm. force them off to stay off in their own little world. You can help them feel that they, you know, can participate and be fully themselves.
Mm-hmm. That's a really cool point. We had our first event of the fall last year was two people on stage talking about citizenship in crisis. And Eric Liu, one of our panelists, he spoke on that very idea, just belonging to something, belonging to a group and to a community. That's how we can create people who truly feel like they belong. So I really like that.
Yeah, and of course, the United States has a long tradition of more insular immigrant communities, mm-hmm. Chinatowns, Koreatowns, all these things, because it is very natural when you're a mm-hmm. brand new immigrant to the country to want to find a community with others like yourself, others yeah. who've come to the country. And so finding ways to sort of integrate people into the community, yeah. some of that just happens naturally over time as mm-hmm. people learn English and manage to sort of spread out beyond immigrant communities. But some of that is through things like Offices of New Americans that help set up programming yeah. and local libraries that begin doing English classes or citizenship classes. Yeah. All of that kind of local advocacy can mm-hmm. often have a much bigger impact than what's going on in Congress or Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really cool to hear. I love it. Thank you for sharing your thoughts on that. I have two more questions for you. So the first, second to last one is, what is your life outside of work like? How do you spend your Saturdays? What do you like to do for fun? What's your favorite part about where you live? Those kinds of things.
I love DC. DC's a great town. I mean, I'm not from there originally, but I've been there for more than a decade now, yeah. and I really like it. It's very walkable, and I like walking around cities.
That's awesome.
It's in the spring and fall, it's beautiful. In mm-hmm. the summer, it's miserable and hot, and you stay inside. In the winter, it's cold and dreary, and you stay yeah. inside. But, you know, as long as you make your way around that, it's a really mm-hmm. nice city, and all the free museums and everything are great.
That's cool.
In my spare time, I play some video games, I read books, but our big thing is skiing. We got into it in my mid-30s, and now it's literally all I make my personality around. So I went skiing twice last weekend, I'll probably yeah. be skiing next weekend, and I'll okay. be skiing the week after that,
yeah.
too. Now it's winter, that means that's everything I do every weekend in the winter, until I suppose I get old enough that it is no longer safe for me to do that.
That's awesome. I've actually, you know, as a Michigander, I grew up in Ohio, but as a Michigander, I've never been skiing, and I feel like I don't even want to tell people that, because people love skiing around here. But I will admit that when you first said skiing, my mind immediately went to water skiing, but then I'm like, no. Okay, he means like snow skiing. But have you ever water skied?
I have at camp when I was when I was like 13, 14.
Okay.
And I was terrible at it.
Okay, so do those skills, do they cross over or no?
Well, I suppose if I went back now that I know how to ski, but I skied for the very first time in my life when I was 34. And so this is not something that I did as a kid, and so
okay,
I really
so
got
hope
started
for
new.
Me.
There is hope for
okay,
you. It is
great.
Not as hard as you think. Now, yeah. I fell a lot the first 3-4 times I did it.
Yeah.
I literally had to spend an entire morning just going down the bunny hill to learn how to turn, because I'd figured out how to stop, kind of, but
yeah. Isn't that like they say Pete's
relatively shallow slope?
Okay.
But once it gets too steep, there is a limit to that, and you need to figure
yeah.
out other ways to stop. And I basically realized that I hadn't figured those out yet,
yeah.
and so like you spend days and you practice it and you get good at it. And
yeah.
now, you know, after 2 years of doing this, I'm up to the point where I'm doing more challenging terrain and feeling
cool.
somewhat confident about my abilities.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's cool to hear. Okay, the last question is how I end all of our podcasts, which is just with the question, like, what advice would you have for people who want to go similar career path as you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest advice that I give to people mm-hmm. is embrace the fact that it's unpredictable. If you had asked me 10 years ago what I would be doing with my life, I would have never told you this. I thought
yeah.
I would be a practicing immigration attorney, or even 10 years ago, I kind of thought that I might, well, 11 years ago before I graduated, I thought I was going to be a public defender.
Okay.
And then I managed to work at a public defender organization doing removal defense, and that was incredibly exciting. And then I had to move to DC to be with my partner, now wife, and I got a job doing litigation, suing the federal government. And then I did that for 2 years, and then I transitioned internally to do policy, which I've been doing for the last 5 years. And at no point did I ever say, like, this is a natural, you know, this is where I was going with my career.
Yeah.
And I think as long as you are, you know, interested in the topic, dedicated, willing to sometimes do some volunteering on the side, be engaged in the topic, meet people, be open to various different ways. Once you've got those skills, once you've actually gotten a foothold into the world of immigration law, the path becomes much easier.
Yeah.
But the reality is unfortunately for policy jobs, there just isn't a huge market for it. A lot of nonprofits have one or two policy people, and the turnover isn't massive. And so what I often tell people is, like, you might often be like me, like, I got into policy after I'd already been doing something else for 4 years. And so people find different ways to it, and embracing those different paths, embracing the way that you never really know where you're going to go. Just do something that you find interesting in the moment and that maybe gets you in the right direction. And I think that's always been the advice I tend to give people.
That's great advice. We have a lot of students who listen and just people trying to figure out their careers. And so I think that's such good advice to, like, no, like, you don't have to be thinking about what are the next 20 years, 10 years, 5 years going to look like? What am I doing right now? And, you know, that kind of idea. So that's awesome.
What are you doing right now? What skills are you building from that? And crucially, are you doing something you like doing? And are you not burning out doing it? Like, practicing self-care and keeping an eye on the long term, I think, is really helpful.
That's awesome. That's so cool to hear. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I'm excited to hear you on our stage tonight. And for those listening, I will link the fellow panelists off the stage episodes in the description so you can listen to those, along with the link to the podcast or the YouTube of the event tonight. And thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to Off the Stage Podcast, a series produced by the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. The Hauenstein Center, inspired by Ralph Hauenstein's life of leadership and service, is dedicated to raising a community of ethical, effective leaders for the 21st century. For more information on our center, our Cook Leadership Academy, or our Common Ground Initiative, visit our website at www.gvsu.edu/hc. To keep up with our current events and reoccurring initiatives, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, all of which can be found linked below. If you liked this episode, consider giving us a review or rating so we can be found by other podcast listeners. Again, thanks for listening to Off the Stage Podcast.